Jemand, der nicht dabei gewesen ist, der wird das gar nicht begreifen, wie furchtbar immer wieder diese rote
leuchtende When we see the sunset this evening, we think about the chimney at Auschwitz, which took thousands of people away.
Der Tausende von Menschen hingerafft hat.
Took thousands of people away. Those were the words of Charlotte Grunow of Berlin. She was speaking into a BBC microphone in April 1945. It was only later that it became clear. It wasn't thousands. It was more than a million people who were killed in Auschwitz alone. More than 6 million Jews were murdered by the Germans. It is estimated that over 60 million people died in the Second World War. Unimaginable numbers. Federal President, Mrs. Friedman, Federal Chancellor, President of the Bundesrat, President of the Federal Constitutional Court, colleagues, excellencies, ladies and gentlemen. The 27th of January 1945, the day Auschwitz was liberated, did not mark the end of the terror. The killing and dying continued for months in Neuengamme, in Buchenwald, in Flossenbürg. A few days later, in the East Prussian village of Palmnicken, 3,000 Jewish women from the Stutthof camp were forced out into the ice-cold Baltic Sea, shot and beaten to death. In Gardelegen, the SS, together with Wehrmacht and Volkssturm troops, crammed over 1,000 camp prisoners into a barn, which they then set alight. The rubble was still smoking when American soldiers reached the site one day later. In Bergen-Belsen, the liberating British troops discovered more than 13,000 bodies strewn throughout the grounds of the camp. They spoke of a carpet of corpses. Hundreds of thousands died in the last months of the war from hunger, disease, on death marches, or by execution. The memories and the pain of the survivors remained. Many felt lifelong guilt. Why have I survived and not my parents, my spouse, my child? 3 years after the Holocaust, in the Parliamentary Council, the mothers and fathers of the Basic Law formulated an initial response to the millionfold dehumanization. They wrote, "Human dignity shall be inviolable." Coming directly after the breach of civilization, this had the impact of a thunderclap. The dignity of every individual is inviolable. When, today, we increasingly define ourselves through identities and membership of certain groups, we obscure what Article 1 protects at its core, not the group, not a collective, but the individual. Article 1 protects the individual in their uniqueness and vulnerability. The Shoah in particular showed where it leads, when people are merely viewed as part of a collective, as a number or a category. In contrast, the Basic Law states, every person counts as an individual. Article 1 is an obligation for the state. It limits power. It protects human existence itself. The sentence is at the beginning of our Constitution because it represents the absolute counter-concept to the vanquished order. It was a promise to all those who could no longer speak, to all those who we remember today. It was a promise to the murdered Jews, the dead Sinti and Roma, the victims among the Slavic peoples, a promise to the millions of people who were persecuted, dispossessed, humiliated, deprived of their rights, tortured, and left to die. Because they thought differently, worshipped differently, loved differently, or because their lives were classified by the Nazis as unworthy. A promise to those who were abused in human experiments, forcibly sterilized, tortured to death, and thrown in ovens. Also to the pregnant women who were abused, where abortion attempts were made in the 9th month of pregnancy. It is a promise to those who were considered mere material, because this view was the foundation of organized mass extermination. We must never forget that. This dehumanization wasn't abstract, it was extremely specific. This scene from the film Nuremberg 45, In the Face of Evil, a film recently broadcast by Germany's public broadcaster ARD, this scene portrays this reality in a devastating manner.
Wir setzen die Versuchsreihe am Nachmittag fort. Lassen Sie neues Material bereitstellen.
Sie sind tot.
Material.
Material.
Menschen als Versuchsware.
People as experimental goods. How on earth could we, humans, be capable of such dehumanization? Those who fail to inherently grant human existence with dignity and irrevocable rights are capable of such dehumanization. Human dignity shall be inviolable. This sentence was a promise to the future in Germany. With Article 1, the mothers and fathers of the Basic Law drew a clear line, this far and never again further. The promise did not just remain words, and yet it took a long time for these to be put into action. German society in the Federal Republic was late to take a critical look at its history by remembering it, by academic examination of it, by legal processes. State prosecutor Fritz Bauer, who initiated the Auschwitz trials, put it as follows.
The process soll der Welt zeigen.
The trial is to show the world that a new Germany, a new German democracy, has the will to uphold the dignity of every single individual. In addition to the Auschwitz trial, there were other key steps on the path to Germany's spiritual and moral rehabilitation. Willy Brandt falling to his knees in Warsaw, the television series Holocaust, and the introduction of this very day of remembrance by the federal president Roman Herzog almost exactly 30 years ago. Another one of these steps is the exhibition that we are presenting here at the German Bundestag beginning today. It recalls the people who were persecuted on account of their Jewish background and who nevertheless contributed to the democratic new start as members of the German Bundestag. They breathed life into the promise made by Article 1. And yet, no lesson is learned forever. We see that the conclusions we came to previously are today fading, along with the memories. Hate is becoming socially acceptable. Even children are learning it again. A few weeks after the attack by Hamas on the 7th of October 2023, the Anne Frank Educational Institute asked school children in the state of Hesse for their opinion. An 11-year-old girl said, and I quote, "I think it's a shame when Palestinian children die, but the Jews don't matter." Children don't talk like that of their own accord. They are influenced by adults. Robbing someone of their dignity does not require physical violence. This dignity is violated when people are systematically belittled, threatened, excluded. That's how it started back then, with words. It didn't start with the gas chambers. It started with exclusion, with looking away. It has become more dangerous for Jews in our country. A terrorist regime is being supported, and there is solidarity with those who hate Jews. It has become more dangerous for Jews in our country. They are attacked because they are Jews. Anti-Semitism commissioners also live in danger, subjected to attacks and arson, as recently seen in Brandenburg. Those who claim responsibility leave the symbol of the Hamas terrorists, and yet the public outcry remains muted. Is this because we've become used to it? That is the reason why many Jews in this country are now once more asking themselves the question, stay or go? This question is directed at our perception of who we are. It has to be historically self-evident for Germany, and excluding Jews goes against the nature of our country. Anyone talking of raison d'état in this country has to start at this point. It is not only defended outside our borders. Our raison d'état begins on Berlin's Sonnenallee, in front of the main synagogue in Munich, in schoolyards, in lecture theatres, on X and TikTok. It is displayed in how we protect Jewish life in Germany. It is displayed in empathy and through the consistent prosecution by our judicial system of anti-Semitic offences. Anyone who lives in Germany benefits from the freedom and protection that the basic law provides. Anyone with a German passport, be it from birth or through naturalization, must respect the framework of this order. It's not a mere suggestion, it's a categorical imperative. Article 1, paragraph 1 of our basic law is not just a promise by the state to me, it is also our promise. Jewish life in Germany is a touchstone for whether we keep this promise. But honestly, this promise is becoming cracked. We don't just remember in this way in order to be permitted to forget. And that's another reason why I'm very grateful that survivors of the Shoah are still able to tell us their stories. Representing all guests of honor today, I would like to personally welcome Eva Shepchi, Charlotte Knobloch and Roman Schwarzmann, who have spoken here in the past. Thanks for coming today. No citizen of this country can ever remain indifferent in the face of anti-Semitism. They cannot shrug their shoulders when Jews have their homes and businesses marked, when they're excluded, accosted and attacked. As Germans, we all bear the special responsibility to push back against the resurfacing hatred of Jews at school and at university, at and after work, online and in our own friendship groups. When thinking of the Holocaust in the past, many people felt this personal and distressing ambivalence and the contradictions. They felt it very personally in their own families. What is it like to love your dad or grandfather and at the same time to suspect that he bears guilt? Journalist Niklas Frank confronted this in a most profound way. His father was Hans Frank, Governor General in occupied Poland. He was sentenced to death for war crimes and crimes against humanity at the Nuremberg trials. The father's guilt has left deep traces to this day in Niklas Frank's own family. Mr. Frank, there is scarcely anyone who has taken such an unforgiving look at their own history as you have. I extend a very warm welcome to you in the visitors gallery.
Doch unsere Gesellschaft, sie verändert sich.
Yet our society is changing. Many people who live here today have a different relationship to Germany than Niklas Frank. Their parents and grandparents were not born in Germany. What does this mean for how we deal with the darkest chapter of German history? Some say, that isn't my history. It's not my family's history. But I say, if this is to be your country, then it is also your history. And that's why we also have to confront the future of remembrance in a world without contemporary witnesses. This space cannot become a vacuum. We have to find new ways of keeping the memory alive. Ladies and gentlemen, many prisoners in the camps were kept alive by their hope of a better future, another world in which human rights were upheld again, in which they didn't have a number but a name, in which they had their freedom and their dignity once more. Today, we live in this future. Here, human rights are upheld. We live in freedom. Let us use this freedom for good. Ladies and gentlemen, we continue to hold this responsibility and we are passing it on to the next generation. This year, our youth encounter focused on the persecution of women and children under National Socialism. The suffering of women and children under the Nazis' tyranny was overlooked for far too long. One of the people who helps us with coming to understand the unimaginable is Tova Friedman. Tova Friedman was born in Poland in 1938. Then, as a child, together with her mother, she was deported to Auschwitz. She survived, likely due to a technical fault in the gas chambers. During the death marches in January 1945, she hid between corpses, and she survived. Later on, she emigrated to the United States of America. Her grandson, Aaron, who I warmly welcome in the visitors' gallery together with his mother, her grandson Aaron set up a TikTok account for his grandmother. There, Tova Friedman speaks about her time in Auschwitz, and she answers questions from children and young people. Over 500,000 people follow her. Okay, there are plenty of TikTok channels, yet this one is unique, because a contemporary witness is speaking out.
I had no name. My name was 27,633. I was tattooed by a young woman whose hands trembled because she wasn't happy to tattoo children. And she told me how to take care of it afterwards so it shouldn't swell. She gave me a rag with cold water, and she told me to press it tightly, not to rub it. And she said, remember, this is your name. You better memorize it. I didn't know any numbers. I've never been to school, but I very quickly memorized it because I knew it was different between life and death.
Liebe Frau Friedman,
Mrs. Friedman, that you still find the strength to this day to tell your story, to remind us of history, and to speak with young people is a gift to us all. We offer our heartfelt thanks to you for coming here from the United States of America to Germany, to a country whose language you no longer wanted to hear. You said, it sounds banal, but it has such a deep meaning. You are afraid of German shepherd dogs. And that's a meaningful statement. And that's why we are grateful that with all your energy and warm-heartedness, you have come here to Germany. And I would like to thank you for speaking to us today. A very warm welcome to you.
was a wonderful program. I appreciate the beautiful words. I understood most of them with the translation and a little bit German. I was very touched. Good afternoon, Federal President Steinmeier, President of the German Bundestag, Kluger, Federal Chancellor Merz, His Excellency Ron Prosor, Ambassador to the State of Israel in Germany, members of the Parliament, honored survivors, guests, ladies, and gentlemen. I am deeply honored and touched to address you today on this very special and solemn occasion. I stand here before you to share a truth that is very painful but essential. I don't have any brothers, any sisters, aunts, uncles. I never knew my grandparents or my great-grandparents because of what was done right here in Germany to millions of Jews during the Second World War. In name of a dehumanizing ideology, anti-Semitism, an ideology that corrupted moral judgment, hollowed out institutions, and ultimately turned ordinary people into participating in extraordinary crimes. I speak today not only for myself, because I'm just one person, but in memory of the 6 million Jews, men, women, and children who were murdered for one reason only, that they were Jewish. Among them, 1.5 million children who were not as lucky as I was to survive. Many were deported to death camps, where within hours of their arrival, especially in Auschwitz, they were stripped of their belongings, their identities, their dignities, and ultimately their lives. Others were murdered by bullets in villages, fields, forests, and ravines across the whole Europe. Entire families were wiped out just where they stood. I am among the diminishing number of survivors who still can bear witness. There are very, very few of us left. We do so not to reopen wounds, but to prevent one thing, amnesia. History has shown us that forgetting is not neutral. It is dangerous. And it gives permission. Who would have imagined that a child known, I get very emotional, so you'll have to forgive me, that a child known only as prison number, A27,633, once designed for death in a gas chamber, would stand here 81 years later before such people as you. I mean, I'm very impressed with everybody I met, committed to remembrance and responsibility. I'm here because others cannot, and because I survived, and because if Holocaust survivors are still here, they have a voice and they must tell the truth. I remember when I was tattooed, you saw a little bit on the movie, but when the woman tattooed me, she was about 18 years old, a Jewish woman. We were about 60 children, aged from 3 to about 8, and we all stood in line. And when I got up to the line and she gave me this number, she said to me, "What's your name?" I gave her, she said, "No, this is your name now." I said, "But I don't know how to read. I don't know numbers. I don't know how I'm going to know what this is." And she said to me, "I will teach you. Listen to me, I will say it to you, because if you don't say I am here, if you don't identify yourself where this number is called, you may be killed. An entire barrack may be punished. So you have to learn it." So at 5 and a half, I'm walking around in the barrack saying words that I didn't know what they were, just sounds. So I should remember this number. And another thing she said to me, "I will give you a very tiny number. So if you survive, you buy yourself a long shirt with long, you know, arms, and you cover it up and nobody will see it." And that the first time I thought to myself, "I will survive? How is that possible? I'm only 5 and a half, but I thought that every Jewish child has to die. This was my mentality. I am the child that Hitler feared. His motto was, "Leave no witnesses." But I speak for those 6 million whose voices are muted, and for the children who are not here. I am your witness. I am your voice. You know, 6 million is a very large number. It's very hard to fathom it. Oh, it's a lot, it's a lot. So let me tell you, take you on a journey of one, me. I will share with you some of my memories. Multiply it by 1.5 million, because the other children experienced the same thing in different camps maybe. But they're not here to tell you. My earliest memory is hiding beneath a table. I was in a small apartment in ghetto, in a town in Poland, Tomaszów Mazowiecki. I am mentioning the name because there's nobody left from the town. I think 2 people are left in this world from that town. I recognize my voice, the voices of my parents, my grandmother, and my uncle. But I knew not to emerge from under the table because it was dangerous. The SS targeted the elderly and children, the most defenseless people, and they were the most useless. My grandmother was shot outside our home while I was hidden, but I heard the gunfire, the dogs, and her screams, and then the terrible silence. When the ghetto was liquidated, most of its population was murdered. You know why? Because there wasn't enough space in the cattle car. So they would fill the cattle car with all trembling Jews, men, women, and children. And if there wasn't enough space, they would just shoot them. My family was forced to remain. A number of people were chosen as the cleaning squad. And that's how we were saved. We had a job to do. Our job was to clean up. I remember walking after my parents as they were picking up bodies to bury. And I remember my father saying something that I didn't understand. It was a prayer in Hebrew. It was a prayer for the dead. And as I grew up and I said to myself, here he is, he's picking up these dead bodies and he is praying to a God, to a silent God. But he still believed. My father later described in his testimony about the deportation. Mothers clutch their small children, their despairing and pitying eyes fastened on those of the tiny little ones, full of grief and sadness. They sensed that their end was near, and with powerless hands, again, they turned to God and they said, Lord of the universe, why have you inflicted on us such a horrible death sentence? A rabbi that my father knew yelled out to him just as the doors of the cattle court were closing. Remember us, remember. It was in Yiddish. Vergess uns nicht. Do not forget us. And I try not to. We arrived in Starchowitz on September 5th, just 2 days before my 5th birthday. It was a slave labor camp surrounded by barbed wires, and there were lookout towers everywhere. But here, there was no place to hide. My parents worked in an ammunition factory. From dusk to dawn, they were the lucky ones. They were at the age, like late 20s, early 30s, where they could get working papers. Only those people were able to survive a few more weeks, maybe a few more months. I remember the sound of my mother's voice. Take care of yourself until I get back. She began teaching me my first survival skills. Remember, don't run when you see the dogs. They are trained to kill if you run, so stand still. Don't look directly into anybody's eyes, not the dogs, not the soldiers. Keep your eyes down, stand still, and let them pass. Try to be invisible. Those were survivor skills, by the way, that saved me many times throughout the war when I was alone without her. I lived with the other children on the street. Our parents were gone, trying to avoid the dogs and the guards. We felt lucky to have temporarily escaped the dreaded selection. Mom, I said to her one day, where are all the people? I asked because the camp seemed a little emptier to me because I was on the street all the time, so I could see that. Selections. I still know that name in German. I don't know too many names, but this is in my mind. My mother answered. She didn't have to say more. I was 5. But I knew what that was. It was selecting people for their deaths. I became more cautious and often stayed in our room alone. Then I heard something absolutely terrible and frightening. Children's selection. A shiver went through every parent. Where to hide them? Where can you hide your children? My parents hid me in a crawl space in the ceiling because they were prepared exactly for that event. The hunters with their guns uncovered almost every trembling, hidden child. and to the screams of their parents, the children were hauled into trucks and driven to their deaths because they were being shot outside of our town and pushed into a grave that was dug by their parents. My life had changed immediately. I couldn't be seen on the street, and I was confined to our little dark room, and the windows were covered with very thick blankets, so nobody should know that I was there. And I waited there. And I remember my thoughts, and I said to myself, am I the only living child on this earth, the only Jewish child? Because again, as I said, I was positive that all Jewish children were destined to die. My memories of that period are very vague. I slept a lot. I cried very quietly because I couldn't be heard, and waited for my parents to come home from the factory at night and give me something to eat. Then, on a beautiful summer day, I was permitted to leave the dark room and enjoy the sun. But my mother was packing. "Where are we going?" I asked her. "To Auschwitz," she answered. At five and a half by then, I was familiar with the name. We all were familiar. I knew that no one returns from that place. But my childish mind was concentrating on the light and sunshine that I was experiencing after weeks of being alone in the darkness. So I didn't react too much. But half an hour later, we were standing at the open doors of the cattle cars. This was the second time I saw my father cry. The first time was when he told my mother that he had just helped his parents on a truck because they were going shot, being shot with the other elderly, also out of town, also placed in a pit that was dug by their children. They kissed and said goodbye. They all knew they would never see each other again. And now standing with us by the cattle cars, he was crying and telling me to be a good girl. I remember he said, "Be a good girl." This was the very first time that our family was separated. At least now the three of us were together. My mother and I were shoved into a cattle car for women, and my father went with the men. 36 terrible hours of darkness, thirst, hunger, and for me, worst of all were the lack of bathroom facilities. I tried to talk to my mom to be comforted, but the terrible loud cries, moans, and prayers of the terrified women drowned out the sound, and it was impossible to speak. Upon arrival to Auschwitz, the doors flew open, and the sudden sunshine hit my eyes. But it was the smell that overwhelmed me. "What is the smell?" I said to my mom. My mother pointed to the dark, thick, noxious smoke that I breathed for the last time and for a whole time that I was in Auschwitz. I knew what it was. She didn't have to tell me. It was the burning of the bodies that permeated the smell and the entire atmosphere of Auschwitz. But me, at my age, I was absolutely frightened and petrified of the dogs. There were dogs standing right there as upon our arrival. And I looked at them, and then I remembered, no eye contact, not with the dogs and not with the guards. And then they shaved my head. I came in with braids. They took away my clothes. And they dressed me in some rags. And I was so hungry and tired and extraordinarily thirsty when we were taken to our new home. It was the middle barrack, the middle bunk in a barrack, a dark black, depressing place. Why weren't we killed right away? Everybody else was. Every child of that age wouldn't even go to the barrack. That was a privilege. We went straight to the gas chamber because we arrived on a Sunday, and the SS were Christian of some type. I don't know what they were, but they didn't want to work so hard on Sundays. So they had four gas chambers going, and they didn't want to open up the fifth. Besides, we came to Auschwitz anyhow. They could get us at any other time. So here, a miracle. Instead of going straight to the gas chamber, we went into the camp itself. And here my mother began teaching me again survival skills. I couldn't have made it without her. And this is what she said to me. You'll get a cup, a bowl, and a spoon. If you lose them, you will not eat, and you will starve to death. It is impossible to describe the starvation. Anything you read, anything you see, all the movies, all the witnesses, there is no way. There is no way to think what it feels like to have nothing to eat or so little that it just keeps your body functioning year after year after year. And then she taught me something else. Don't cry. Don't cry, no matter what happens to you. If you cry, you will be considered weak. Weak people, weak kids do not survive. I didn't cry when I was standing on a appel. An appel was a roll call that lasted 4 hours. I was standing, and because I couldn't stand still, I was beaten by a woman, SS. I did not make a sound. I didn't cry when I got very sick and everything hurt. In fact, I tried to cover my illness because I knew what happens to sick people, because every morning they would come with a wheelbarrow and pick up the weak and the sick, and we knew where they were going. I didn't cry when I was tattooed. And I didn't cry when I was taken away from my mother. And I didn't cry when, naked, freezing, and starving, I was waiting with other children for the door of a gas chamber to open. They had told all the children we're going to somewhere. And we were given a great meal before that. And you know what? We didn't care about the gas chamber. We wanted the food. And after we ate, we started walking to the gas chamber. When we arrived, they told us how to get undressed. And we got undressed. And then we waited for a room that had a little window for the room to open. And meanwhile, we were starving, freezing, very cold. I did not cry. And I didn't cry when my mother tucked me in with a corpse in order to avoid the death march in Auschwitz. She said to me, I can't walk. I'm not being able to walk to Germany. They wanted us to walk like hundreds of miles without shoes, without food. It's freezing now today here. And I remember being colder, maybe because I had no clothes and I had no food. She said, let's die together in Auschwitz here. And we did. Let's hide. She said, either we'll survive or we'll die together. And we went, and then she found a corpse, and she tucked me in. And I knew that she wasn't far away, and I didn't cry because I couldn't be heard, because they were checking the corpses to see if any of the corpses are really alive, and then they can be shot. Remember, leave no witnesses? Against all reason, my mother and I survived. As we left Auschwitz, walking hand in hand, she whispered and said to me, remember, she said, remember, I was 6 and a half, and I remember it every day of my life. After liberation, the future she promised me never existed. She said to me, while we were in Auschwitz, oh, you're going to meet this great family. I have sisters and brothers and nieces and nephews, hundreds of people. You'll see, you'll have Jewish holidays together. This terrible life is not forever. That's what she said to me while I was trying to recuperate after the war, in Auschwitz still. But when we came back to Poland, there was nobody there. She lost 150 people, and she didn't even want to continue living. She was the sole survivor of that family. My father returned from Dachau, completely broken in body and spirit. He could rarely speak. My mother died at 45. I was 18 years old. She physically survived Auschwitz. Her heart never left, though. And she once said to me, this is not a world for human beings or for children. I learned about her death while on a college trip in Israel, a lifelong dream for us. Israel is not simple a place on the map. It's the heart of a 3,000-year-old story, a story of faith, longing, loss, and return. Even if in our darkest moments, Israel symbolized hope, continuity, and the belief that despair would not have the final word. After the Holocaust, it became a moral and existential necessity, the assurance that Jewish life would never again depend solely on the mercy of others. Now, 81 years later, much of the world has turned against us. I walked out of Auschwitz thinking, I'll never have to be afraid again to be Jewish, never again. But here we are. My grandson needs to hide his Jewish star on campus. Right now, today, my granddaughter was forced to leave her dormitory because she was harassed by the other students. Shouts of Hitler was right and gas the Jews are heard on the street of New York, Paris, Amsterdam, London, and maybe in Berlin. That I don't know, but I assume it's so. Jews around the world again feel exposed, targeted, and hated. Is this the world that young people are inheriting? Is this what we're giving to them, to my children, to my grandchildren? A world filled with hatred and fear, where Jews are once again made the scapegoats for society's ills? This is exactly how it began right here in the 30s. It just began just like that. Anti-Semitism has not disappeared. It has adapted. It now is often disguised in a new anti-Zionist language, spreading with alarming speed through social media, and finds acceptance in spaces that should stand for critical thinking and moral clarity, like universities and other academic institutions. I went to, spoke at a university in America where the Jewish students came and told me that they're afraid to write essays that are positive towards Israel or towards Jews in general because the professors will lower their grades. And we had to talk about it. What can I tell them? Sacrifice a grade? You may sacrifice your future or sacrifice your faith and your own moral standard? I really have no answer. I know I have an answer for me, but I'm an old lady. I have very little to lose, and that's fair to say. But what can I say to the young people? What can I say to my grandchildren? Hide your Jewish star and get an A? Or show your Jewish star and get a B? And then you have trouble getting into graduate school or get a job. It's a terrible, terrible dilemma we live in. These are warnings that you have to heed, as your president said. History teaches us that hatred never confined itself to one people. When anti-Semitism is tolerated, democratic values in general in that particular country is weakened and may even is in danger of disappearing. Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks, he was a rabbi for 22 years in England and beloved by Christian and Jews, reminded us that while armies defend nations, education defends civilization. Education, leadership, and moral courage is therefore not optional. They are obligations. I acknowledge with gratitude Germany's sustained commitment to confronting anti-Semitism through education, remembrance, and policy. Germany understands, perhaps more deeply than other nations, what happens when hatred is normalized and the responsibility is deferred. Your national strategy against anti-Semitism and your resolution, Never Again Is Now, protects and strengthens Jewish life. Your programs of sending both teachers and students to Israel and to concentration camps provide an appreciation and better understanding of our people and our history. Germany you here, has learned from bitter experience what unchecked hatred towards an entire people can do to the moral and emotional fiber of a nation. Unfortunately, it doesn't seem to be enough. Therefore, it is because you have now anti-Semitism is growing in this country, and you have somehow to strengthen the campaign to work even harder through policy, education, and protection of its citizens. I was afraid to come here. I haven't been here. This is the first year that I came back to Germany. I thought it's going to be a terrible place for me. I was scared if I saw dogs on the street or the German language. But I found a wonderful, kind, warm people. Very receptive, very understanding, and very, very willing to fight anti-Semitism. But I hate to tell you, it's just not enough. It isn't enough. You know, you have to take your country back from the terrible anti-Semitic organizations. Not that gently as you're doing it. Last time, you allowed a crazy man to take over your country and to destroy you and people around him, and you are still recuperating. Now use your chance, please, to fight it, to take back your country with strength. I mean, you are such wonderful, wonderful people. You gave us Bach, you gave us Beethoven. I read Goethe. I may not agree with him, but I read Goethe. So therefore, you have so much to be proud. And since I came here with people in the States and my family is going to ask me, how was Germany? The only thing I can say, it was a wonderful, very healing experience for me. But as one of the maybe, I hope not, one of the last survivors of Auschwitz. I don't know how many there are left. I beseech you, don't let anti-Semitism grow and bloom here. Don't let them get away. Have learned from such terrible experience that negotiating and doing the right thing may not work always. So I just hope with all my heart that you become, say, a little tougher. Now, I don't know anything about politics, but a little tougher so they are scared of you. You are the most important people in Germany that are sitting right now. You have the power to do that. Please use it. Use your power to fight them, because we don't want for them to be more powerful. The way you have learned from bitter experience, when it may be too late. Because it's so scary for me even to sit in New York and to think about what is happening again in this world that I thought was finished already. The younger generations are not responsible for what happened, for what their ancestors did in Treblinka, Auschwitz-Birkenau, Majdanek, Bergen-Belsen, Dachau, and other Nazi camps. But you, they are not responsible, but you, who in a position of such leadership are responsible for shaping the world. Not only for your children, for your grandchildren, for your great-grandchildren, and for mine. And that means taking this pestilence, this epidemic, this hatred, this anti-Semitism very, very seriously. Neutrality in the face of hatred is not neutrality, it is permission. In our synagogue, every Sabbath, we pray for our leaders, that they govern with wisdom, courage, and compassion, that justice, security, and dignity may prevail, and that people of all faiths and backgrounds may live together without fear or exclusion. May remembrance lead to responsibility. May responsibility lead to action. And may action ensure that never again is not a slogan, but a lasting commitment. I spend my days trying to educate others, especially the younger generation, by speaking in schools, colleges, universities, and through social media like TikTok. I will continue doing this until the day I die. And I want to thank you with everything in me for the opportunity to be here and for the wonderful, warm, kind treatment that I have received here, the president, and from everybody I met, president. For me, my daughter, and my grandson, we will never forget this. Thank you.